got till it's gone. It'd be a paradise to put up a fucking line.
Welcome to At the Table. I'm Clark Wolf, and this is the weekly radio show about all things food, brought to you from Sonoma County. Not just wine country, but farm country and food country. And today I am joined by someone who's been here before, who's been with us a number of times, who has just produced the most wonderful and fascinating memoir, foodwar, she calls it. It's called Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. And of course, I'm talking about Marion Nessel. Welcome back to At the Table, Marion.
Oh, so glad to be here.
So I want to start by saying we're very excited that you'll be joining us here in Sonoma County at the Petaluma location of Copperfields, where I'll have the pleasure of kind of, I don't really, it's not even a conversation, I'll be giving you the floor to talk about this wonderful book. And I know that a lot of people are going to want to come and be there and get books and meet you and speak with you. This book is unique. I mean, we've had a lot of memoirs in the world of food the last 10 years, certainly starting with Ruth Reichel. I'm certainly in the spirit of MFK Fisher. But as time has gone along, it's been chefs, it's been farmers. And now you, your voice, your career, your particular position in food politics, in the world of food, that's not only a fascinating story, but a really interesting reflection of our entire time period. What got you to write this book?
Oh, the pandemic. Yeah. I moved upstate to be with my partner, and it's pretty quiet up there. I was avoiding getting sick, and I thought, what can I do? I can't get into library. I can't get into my office. I can't get at my research materials. Why don't I deal with the questions that I'm asked all the time about my, how did I get started? What was my family like? When did I get interested in food? All these personal questions that, you know, I was developing a set of anecdotes about that I was talking about over and over and over again. And I thought, why don't I answer those questions and sit down and try to do this in some systematic way? As I like to put it, this is my first work of fiction.
Yeah, that's very funny. This is your first work of fiction. Well, it is storytelling. I mean, your writing style has always been very clear and precise and accessible. But here you really are writing from personal experience. But while there's a lot that's personal about it, I think the meat of it is how you as an individual, you as somebody who was a scientist, who became a very involved academically, kind of navigated your way through the world as a young woman.
Rather clumsily, as I explained. Yes, I think, you know, that's a story that may or may not be of interest to young women today, but at the time that I came of age, expectations for women were extremely low and the barriers were extremely high. You were expected to get married and have children. That was your life. And, you know, I did that. I was trying really hard to conform. I did that. Oh, dear. So I got two really terrific children out of it.
Yeah, you know, but it is interesting. I do think that young women will want to hear this. And I think actually men of all ages should hear this because it made me remember when my mother had a credit card and it had my father's name on it, Mrs. and my dad. And I remember finding it after they passed and I just thought, what the heck is this? And my older brother reminded me that that was at a time when that's the only way a woman could get a credit card.
Well, I tell the story of one of the most traumatic things that happened after my divorce when I couldn't get a credit card. I had no credit of my own, and I ended up decompensating in the middle of a bank. I just burst into sobs in the middle of a bank when I was refused for the umpteenth time. I had a job with a completely reasonable salary, and I couldn't get a credit card. Somebody got me one.
Well, it just goes to prove that actually expressing your emotions and your needs sometimes works out. Something that women and men should learn about. What took you from that position of just trying to find your place in the world as an individual to the study of food and nutrition and what came after?
Well, Well, I was handed a nutrition course to teach on my first teaching job. And as I just have always said, it was like falling in love. I just could see what a wonderful way this would be to teach undergraduate biology. I was in a biology department teaching cell and molecular biology, which is kind of abstract, fascinating, but abstract. And this was so engaging. I could give sophomore students at Brandeis original research papers to read in nutrition, and they would be able to criticize them. They would be able to look at the studies and say, oh, too few subjects, not carried on long enough, not well controlled. And that kind of thing was just a wonderful way to teach critical thinking in biology. And in that first class, I used textbooks that included, Francis Moore Lappe's Diet for a Small Planet had just come out. I used that in my first class. And the advocacy group Center for Science and the Public Interest had just published Food for People, Not for Profit, which is a group of essays on everything connected with food, from agriculture to climate change and public health. And so I was sort of in the interdisciplinary nature of food right from the beginning, and the politics of food right from the beginning. And of course, the best part is you can eat it.
Yes, you can eat it. I'm talking to Dr. Marion Nestle. She is the author of a new book. She's the author of a number of books that are very important to all of us: Food Politics, What to Eat. But her new memoir, Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics, is just out and absolutely worth the read. We're talking about the kind of inception of your excitement about all of these things and the value of critical thinking, which is always a good thing to bring up in any conversation. But also, you know, the fact that there's some more personal aspects to this book is very appealing, because there's an intimacy to food in general. It's interesting that you started by saying people keep asking you questions, how you got to be where you are. But in food, the source of all things, inspiration, connection, understanding, learning, becomes more and more interesting every day. How did you go from that biology class to what happened next?
Well, I was married, and I followed my husband to a job in San Francisco where I taught nutrition to medical students for 8 or 10 years at the University of California in San Francisco. And I taught, you know, I was teaching clinical nutrition, nutrition in medical practice. I wrote a book called Nutrition in Clinical Practice. I was right on top of what was going on in nutrition education for medical students at the time. And I have to say, that situation has not changed in all those years. That book came out in 1985. It's out of date, but the issues are still the same. And medical students are still not taught about nutrition for the same reasons they weren't then. They don't get reimbursed. Doctors don't get reimbursed for preventive health care.
Right.
But, I really didn't start on the food politics career until I came to NYU, which for me was a miraculous experience. I came to it with tenure as a full professor, and it was a platform that felt really secure to me, and I was able to think about I was chairing a Department of Home Economics, and I was thinking, how am I going to do an academic career on something that is meaningful and interesting to me in a situation in which I don't have access to a laboratory, and in which there's not a lot of research going on around me or research groups going on around me. And I was lucky enough or fortunate enough or prescient enough to hit on the idea that I could write about food politics, which came about from after going to a meeting of academics, physicians, and scientists who were anti-smoking advocates. And they showed slides of cigarette marketing. And I had this great revelation. I had seen cigarette marketing. I knew that cigarette companies marketed to adults and children, but I never paid any attention to it. It was so much a part of the landscape, I just didn't notice it. And I thought, you know, we should be doing this for Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
We should be looking at the way that Coca-Cola markets to children. And I started looking. And that was really it.
You know, it's so extraordinary. All right, we only have about a minute and a half in this segment. We are going to talk more about these issues. But in order to do that, coming from home economics and then getting to NYU, and it's clear that the notion of some security in developing a new academic field of study, really a discipline, a multidisciplinary discipline, is a fairly unique thing. When we come back, I want you to tell us a little bit about that early time there. I do also want you to think about the impact both before and later that Northern California might have had on your thinking about food in general, because spending time in San Francisco, you talked about being at UCSF, that was at a time when doctors were, in my experience, fat and smoking. And, you know, if you said that you wanted to eat fruits and vegetables, they would say, well, it's probably not going to hurt you, and, you know, give you a prescription for something that was going to have your kidneys fail in no time. I'm just, you know, being a little bit. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk with Marian Nessel about how she brought these interests and her sense of revelation about, I don't know, watching what Coca-Cola was doing to all of us that led to the development of food studies in America, right back here at the table. We are back at the table. I am Clark Wolf, and I'm talking to Dr. Marian Nessel. She is the author of a number of really important books, and her newest is A Foodwar, a memoir with her food life called Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. And just to let you know, she will be in the Bay Area and in Northern California in general, starting early in November, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I can't remember exactly, but go to foodpolitics.com and click the little widget that says appearances and see when she'll be in the community and sign up, show up, and listen up. You know, it's interesting, Marian, we're talking about how you suddenly realized that tobacco companies couldn't be trusted. We had proof of that. And you thought, well, maybe we should take a look at how food companies might or might not be trusted. And then you developed a program where we began to have people in our lives, you're at the top of that list, who could be trusted, who are actually studying and examining and articulating and analyzing. Talk about the birth of the food studies program.
Well, I can't talk about the birth of the food studies program without talking about your role. So I'm going to have to do that. I have been hanging around with a group called Old Ways Preservation and Exchange Trust and going on fabulous trips with them all over the world with, 100 or 200 food writers, chefs, people in the food business, a few academics, and I was getting the message loud and clear that there was really a strong interest in learning more about food, in hiring people who knew more about food, not only what it was and where you bought it at the grocery store, but what it really ought to taste like, where it came from, what its cultural meanings were, what the cuisine was that it was most associated with, and a great deal of cultural, historical information and taste information about food and food ingredients. And so I was hearing this a lot. And when a program in our department was taken away from us and put into and transferred to another school in NYU, we had a big budget gap that needed to be filled. And the dean asked me what I wanted to fill it with, and I said food studies. It just kind of came off the top of my head. Julia Child had encouraged and helped develop a gastronomy program at Boston University, which was largely based on cooking. And I knew that wouldn't work at NYU, but there were lots of programs called studies of one kind or another, and I thought that would work. And everybody felt sorry for us and allowed us to do that. And then the question was, how are we going to do it? And that was when you and I went to a book signing by Marion Burroughs and decided, of all things, to walk down to the village 3.5 miles And Chad, and on that way, you asked me if you could help me with what was going on in the department. And I said, how could you help me? And he said, watch me. And I did. And I've been watching you ever since.
Well, all right. But I mean, that's very kind. And you've always been very generous about telling those stories. But you also are a great collaborator. I mean, I have to say, you've always given complete credit whenever possible. I mean, it's almost a character thing, but it's also a scientific thing, right? That when you learn about things, you credit their source in a thoughtful, accurate way. And throughout this book, you present example after example of who helped you and how they helped you and what that meant, or who you collaborated with, who you worked with, what the result was. I mean, you know, in talking about this book a bit, it has finally occurred to me that it is a very scientific approach.
Well, it is, and I approach things scientifically. I mean, my doctoral is in molecular biology, and that was fabulous scientific training. It really was. And so that's how I think. It was very compatible with the way that I think. And you don't lose anything by giving credit. You gain. Everybody wins. It's one of those wonderful win-win situations. And most of what everybody does is collaborative. And not everybody gives credit. But I try to, and I hope I don't forget.
Well, you know,
credit somebody.
You're extraordinary about it. I'm talking to Marion Nestle. She's the author of Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. Let's go right on to, once this program launched, and it took a minute, but you know, there were the different kinds of teachers and talent that you brought together, and then some things kind of generated on their own. But then you began to be a very important voice nationally and internationally in food politics, but also food policy, public policy. Talk a little bit about that transition from being an academic trying to figure out how to make the department work, but with tenure, folks, don't forget that, to somebody who, you know, has been interviewed by more people, my goodness, on many related topics.
Well, I think that's Marion Burroughs again. Because in 1991, the Department of Agriculture withdrew its pyramid food guide under very dicey circumstances. And I got private information from somebody in Washington that I knew about what had really happened. And she said, we're not allowed to talk to the press. Can you talk to the press about this? And I said, sure. And she started sending me documents in plain brown envelopes. It was like a spy story. And I had met Marion Burroughs when I was in Washington, and asked her if she was interested in receiving these documents. She was indeed, and boy, did she run with them. So she published story after story after story about how the meat industry had forced the Department of Agriculture to withdraw this, because the meat industry didn't like where meat appeared on the pyramid. And she worked on that story for a year, and so did I. I put together a press kit and sent it. I was quoted in a lot of the stories, and each quotation led to more. And I had a press kit that I sent out to reporters with the documents and the graphics and all of the different designs. And it was really a lot of fun. I felt like I was acting out Deep Throat. Something out of Bob Woodward is really fun. But by the end of that, I had talked to reporters at dozens and dozens of publications, and that's never stopped.
Yeah, we're going to call them the Pyramid Papers. I think that's the new term. And what it led to was you being a good source for verifiable, reliable information. And that happens and goes on to this day. Is there a particular pressure that brings you, or is it just simply natural because that's the only information that ever comes out of you?
Well, the pressure is to try to get the stories right.
Yeah.
You know, I really care about food and nutrition, and I want those stories to be right. There's a lot of very silly information that gets published about nutrition. I call it Nutri-fluff. And there's quite a lot of it around. And so if a reporter is writing a story about a serious issue, I just assume they get it right. And certainly with Marion Burroughs, who's a very demanding reporter, I would drop everything and do whatever research was necessary in order to get the right answer. I mean, I have a pretty elaborate trial system, so I can get my hands on things quite quickly. And it wasn't that hard to do. And it was also fun to talk to them, because good reporters are really fun to talk to. And I don't have colleagues who are interested in the same kinds of things that I am. So if I have a reporter to talk to, it's really fun.
Yeah, it's true. Having known Marion Burroughs for many, many years, she really does train the mind to think clearly and quickly and be willing to see whatever you've said in print internationally. So you better get it right. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about a recent event that you attended, the White House Conference on Hunger and Nutrition and Health, which really has to be said, it may well be a result of a lot of the other things we've been talking about and a lot of the efforts and probably Marion Burroughs exposing everybody. We'll be right back here with Marion Nestle at the table. Back at the table, I'm Clark Wolf, and I'm talking to Dr. Marion Nestle. She's the author of the recently published Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics, a food war, a memoir, a professional memoir, a food memoir, a kind of a very important perspective on a piece of history of our food culture and public culture, really, for the last number of years. But recently, Marion, you attended something that was very exciting for you and everybody else involved, and frankly, has repercussions for all of us. A couple weeks ago, the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. And as I understand it, it's the first one of its kind that's been held in years.
Since 1969.
Wow.
The 1969 White House Conference was under the administration of Richard Nixon, who had kicked it off by saying that he just thought it was indescribably horrible that there were hungry people in America. This was right after the discovery of people who looked like they were starving in developing countries under war situations. And it was really quite shocking for the American people at the time. And so they pulled this conference together to try to address the question of hunger and nutrition generally. Obesity wasn't as much of a problem in 1969 as it is now. So that was on the agenda, but not by much. And a great deal came out of that conference. The WIC program, school food, changes in the SNAP, in the food stamp program. I mean, it really had a big impact. And a congressman from Massachusetts, Jim McGovern, who represents the anti-hunger community in Congress and leads this, has been working for years to try to get another White House conference to try to solve the hunger problem once and for all. And because rates of hunger and food insecurity dropped so precipitously during the pandemic because of the measures that were taken by the Biden administration, he thought this would be a good time to do it.
Well, it clearly was the right time to do it. And certainly, I have to say, even before we get to the themes and the impressions and the responses and the possible next steps, getting back into the room with people with whom you've worked and lived and had experiences with over the years must have been very invigorating.
Oh, it was so inspiring. It really was. First of all, it was just wonderful to see people that I hadn't seen in 3 years. These are members of the food community, chefs and academics and food writers and all kinds of people who were there. All of them just so energized by being in a room in which the President of the United States, the Secretary of Agriculture, several senators and Congress people actually were talking about issues that have been concerns of ours for years. It was very, very exciting.
And it was, to some degree, bipartisan, yes?
Minimally. They tried to make it bipartisan. It was mostly Democratic. There were a few Republican There was one Republican senator there and a few others, but they had tried very, very hard to make it a bipartisan. I mean, what could be more bipartisan than doing something about hunger? But doing something about hunger is expensive, and so that divides Republicans from Democrats. But certainly the people who were there were united in saying that hunger is just absolutely unacceptable in a country that's as wealthy as ours, and we really need to do something about it. And there were lots of suggestions, and the White House published a strategy. It has an elaborate website with information about what happened at the conference and of videotapes and things that you could watch. But I was interested in it from a food standpoint because by far the most impassioned, important, and political speech was given by the chef Jose Andres.
It was
an extraordinary speech, met with an ovation deservedly. And he did all of the policy recommendations. It was just amazing, just absolutely amazing. And he had come from Puerto Rico the day before because of the hurricane, and he'd been with D.C. Central Kitchen there, feeding millions of people in Puerto Rico, and flew in and then flew out right away to go to Florida. But it was, there was a lot of glamour there. That, I mean, he's the glamour person. There's a lot of glamour. And the...
What's the website? Could you tell us that?
White House Conference. That's on hunger.
That's very doable. You know, I think of two things. Number one, I had a friend many years ago in the restaurant business who said, I can increase wine sales by 30% by bringing the staff together and saying red wine, white wine. And a lot of times just bringing stuff up to the public eye, and I've heard this on radio stations, on conversations for the last number of days since this conference, just talking about it gets things moving in a direction. And forgive me for being political, but we have noticed that when the Biden administration does things that are really good, even if the Republicans vote against it, they take credit for whatever happens on the other side. So maybe this will all work out.
Maybe it will. I mean, we'll have to wait and see what actions are taken. There were many, many suggestions for actions. And one of the things they had done was to call for private organizations and corporations to make pledges about what they would do to take action against hunger. And they have about $8 billion worth of pledges that have come in. So you hope that if all of these things actually happen, and if Congress will pass some decent legislation, then we might actually take steps to start solving this. But I think the high level visibility of this has a benefit, just as you said. And it sure was fun to be there. That's all I can say.
Well, that is one of the other things about food that really comes to the bottom line. And that is that at the end of the day, it was lunch. It was dinner. It was, you know, in our last minute in this segment, I want to bring back to everyone's attention that Mary Nessel will be here in Northern California, Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco, and here in Sonoma County at the Copperfields in Petaluma with me on Friday, the 4th of November. So make a plan to be there. But I also need to tell everyone that in the many years I've known you, Marion, most meals end with you having a cookie. Now, mind you, many meals are preceded by a good fresh air walk, but the idea that you're not afraid of any food, that you really love good food, makes all that you share with people so much more vibrant and credible we can't wait for the next meal. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the conference and a little bit more about her book right back here at the, national, Republican, Democratic, and absolutely everybody in every community table. Back at the table, I'm Clark Wolf, and I'm here talking to Dr. Marion Nessel. She is the author of the newly published Foodwar, she calls it. It's a memoir about her career and her life in food called Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. She will be here in Sonoma County on November 4th at the Copperfields in Petaluma, and I will be happy to welcome her then. You are all welcome to come on down, buy a book, ask some questions. You know, Marian, questions is where we began this conversation. At the latter part of your book, you talk about kind of how things are now and where they're going, and you finished this book before kind of the, I don't want to say end of the pandemic, but the end of the crisis, and before this conference that you talked about it at the White House. What's your outlook these days?
Well, it's cautious. I think one has to be cautious. The pandemic isn't over, and we don't know where it's going to go and what's going to happen with that. But from a food system standpoint, I think it taught us a lot about the food system. We learned from the pandemic that supply chains don't work, that people who work in grocery stores are paid very little and treated badly, and delivery people are treated badly, and people who work in meatpacking plants are treated badly and are at great risk. This is a big revelation. People didn't know this. People didn't realize that that the supply chains are bifurcated, so that there's one supply chain for food service and one supply chain for retail stores, and they don't mix and they can't cross over. And we had the great irony of food producers destroying food because they had no outlet for it at the same time that cars were lined up for miles to get food handouts from food banks. So these kinds of anomalies and difficulties and flaws in the food system were made very, very obvious. And, you know, if the pandemic did anything, it was to reveal that.
You know, it's ironic, I mean, or it's kind of crazy to me, because many, many years ago, and I'm talking about 1979 and 80, when I opened the Oakville Grocery for Joe Phelps in San Francisco, based on the one that was in the Napa Valley, we were gathering things, and I was doing this very strange thing. I was not just getting specialty foods from the regular people who brought olive oil and cheeses and all that, but I was getting ingredients from chefs' resources. That crossover between the grocery, specialty food, packaged, made food world, and we were getting 22-pound blocks of Belgian chocolate and breaking them up and wrapping them individually and weighing them so that regular customers, folks at home, could buy this exotic stuff. Of course, you know, trickle-down doesn't always work with food, but some of that example played out in a very broad way. And in the midst of all this, we found out that we actually could go to a farmer's market and not only get a bag of really nutritious, delicious food, but that it wasn't that hard to cook it. If we had the facility at home, which could be pretty modest, and that so many more parts of every plant were edible and cookable than we remembered or that we ever thought. I mean, more and more that kind of conversation, certainly here in Sonoma County, happened, where suddenly, you know, when I was raised in Southern California, it was always about, can we take the tops of those off for you, ma'am? And here is now, when you go to a farmer and their turnips or their radishes or whatever it is, they say to you, you know, if you take these and you braise them quickly throw them in a pan with olive oil. I mean, it's really a different mindset. We've certainly seen that here in farm country. Have we seen it a little bit anywhere across the country?
Oh, I think we've seen it everywhere. You can go to any supermarket in America now and find fresh ingredients that, you know, if you know what to do with them, that you can put together into something terrific. The food in supermarkets is much better now than it was 30 or 40 years ago. That's one of my indications of progress. There are more farmers markets. There's more community-supported agriculture. There are more of all of these kinds of farm-to-school programs, farm-to-work site programs, and of course the one that interests me is that there are more and more students interested in food studies and more universities and colleges that have food studies programs. I learned about two more of them when I was at the White House conference. People told me, oh, we're starting a minor in food systems.
Well, all right, so speak to that for a moment. We only have about a minute and a half, but talk about the difference between food studies, kind of the culture of it, sensory evaluation, history, and all that, economics and politics, and the system part of it.
Well, systems is part of food studies. Food studies involves everything that is involved with food from the time it's produced, transported, purchased, cooked, wasted, and also its meaning in culture, in religion, in society, in economics, in politics. It's just the whole thing, with food systems being part of it. So we have, at NYU, we have food and culture and food systems as two different ways to specialize in food studies, but there are many other ways of doing it, too. And it's just exciting to see how many programs there are. The last time I looked, there were 65 or 70 programs in the United States.
Yeah, it's truly extraordinary, and a great credit to the logic of it all, and also to the work that you have done, and to the library that you've built. The library at the Fales Rare Books and Collections, folks, is actually called the Marion Nestle Food Studies Collection. It has something like 70,000 volumes and maybe 12 or 15,000 food pamphlets, which are as upsetting as they are funny in many cases, but we'll get to that another time. We'll be right back here at the table. Table for our last few minutes, this time with Dr. Marion Nestle, who has just published Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics, which sounds like an awfully wonderful life, very enriching, very fulfilling, very exciting, sometimes frustrating. Marion, if you were to say what you hope people will take away from this book, I mean, there's so much here, there's so many topics here that are worth digging into, but, you know, what are the big themes you hope people will grab?
I hope that they'll be interested in the story of somebody who came of age in the 1950s and realized that people's careers aren't born when they're 5 years old. Most people don't know what they want to do. That persist gets you a long way.
It really persistence and rigorous effort, serious study. I too get asked from time to time, so how did you get the career you have? And the only answer I can say is I have no idea. I mean, I just did the next thing that was in front of me and then the thing that was in front of that. And you seem to, I mean, obviously you do that with a great deal of intention. But as you go around the country and you're beginning to have these conversations with people, the other books that you've written, of course, bookstores, but you know, academic environments. This book is really a very broadly appealing conversation about so many topics. Do you think that the venues will be different than they've been before?
Well, I really don't know. I'm very eager to find out people's reactions to the book. You know, it's the first time I've ever written anything like this, and I have no idea how people will react. I'm getting early comments. I have one review at the time that we're talking. One review has been published very favorably in Forbes, and that was kind of nice. I thought, well, maybe this is going to be okay. But I really want to hear people's personal reactions to it. What is it about the book that strikes them? And what I'm hearing in the really early stages is very different things. People are seeing it in very different ways, and that's exciting.
It's also how I've experienced you over many, many years, which is that you're interested, you're curious, you listen, and you use that information effectively and for the general good. I cannot tell you how pleased I am that you're going to be coming back here to Sonoma County. Folks, if you don't know, Marion was here a number of years ago in the middle of January when I believe it was 78 degrees, and we all gathered with a curator at the time at the Bobes Library at the Fales Rare Books and Collections, Marvin Taylor, and we went to Schoen Farm, our beloved 365-acre farm here in Sonoma County, and talk to a lot of people about food, which I suspect, Marion, you will be doing throughout this book tour and for many years to come. Thank you so much for the time you spent with us, and we look forward to seeing you in just a couple of weeks.
Me too. Looking forward to seeing you.
All right, we'll see you here in California. Just remember, it's foodpolitics.com. We'll see you at the Petaluma Copperfields on November 4th. At 7 o'clock, I think it is. Look it up. And we'll see you there at the bookstore at the table.